You're listening to Teatro Mundi Live. I'm Andrea Cetrullo, Program Curator at Teatro Mundi, and this is the second episode of Hybrids, a podcast series focusing on the notion of hybridity as mixture, contamination, and symbiosis. How do apparently distinct entities, be they human or not, interact, feed from each other, and combine their individualities in order to create something entirely new? We invited four guests to answer this question through the lens of choreography, architecture, medical history, mathematics, ecology, and gastronomy. For the second installment of Hybrids, I'm joined by David Monroe, Sybarite, Associate Professor of Applied Ethics at St. Petersburg College in Florida, and former chef. We will talk about the work of relatively obscure French author, Michel Serres, who wrote extensively about the phenomenology of taste, culinary aesthetics, and wine, and also conceptualized the figure of the parasite to describe relationships between humans, humans and non-humans, and amongst non-human entities. What can a bottle of good wine tell us about the local and the universal? How can taste teach us how to live a better life and become more discerning in our everyday choices? What is the philosophy of mingled bodies? And is every relationship in this world fundamentally parasitic? Welcome, Dave, to this episode of Hybrids. Thank you for being with me today. I'd like us to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in the philosophy of the senses and the aesthetics of food.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast and giving me a space to talk about the philosophy of food and Michel Serres, which are both passions of mine. I became interested in philosophy of food because prior to academics, actually, and an interruption to academics, I was a chef for a period of about 13 or 14 years. So I had started university right out of high school and found that it wasn't for me. And I took some time off and went to work in a national park in a restaurant and fell in love with that whole sort of way of being. I just really liked the restaurant work. And then through that, I started to fall in love with food. So it actually weirdly started as like a sociological thing where I just really liked being part of a team. And then it became a passion for food that then became a passion for the entire sort of culinary world. I did it the old school way in the States. Now we have culinary schools, but I apprenticed to a master chef the way that so the old tradition worked. And then over time, decided to go back to university because restaurant work is a very hard life, but I still really appreciate food and all of its different sensory experiences that it can provide. When I went back to university, I decided that I wanted to do philosophy, which was a really strange choice. And people used to joke, you know, when you get a philosophy degree to go back to being a chef, which, you know, there's maybe some justice to. But along the way, one of my classes was in philosophy of art. And my philosophy of art professor knew that I was a chef and said, well, you know, there's this book called Making Sense of Taste that you might want to read by a philosopher named Carolyn Korsmeyer, who I think maybe retired now, but for years worked at the University of Buffalo. So I read that book and thought, wow, this is really interesting because it exposed all sorts of prejudices in Western philosophical tradition, both rooted in gender, but above all in her work, rooted in what she called the hierarchy of the senses. And if you think closely about the way that most Western philosophers work, it's usually framed in terms of reference to visual concepts. So visual arts are sort of elevated above sort of other arts like high art and low art, or arts and crafts, that this sort of distinction. So food would usually falls in the craft category, where painting falls in the art category, right? Which is a visual distinction by and large. She focused in on the sense of taste and the really interesting things that taste can tell us, right? Asking the question of whether or not taste provides knowledge, whether or not taste is too subjective to really tell us anything interesting or just sort of expresses preferences or sort of embodied pleasures. And I was really fascinated by this idea of the hierarchy of the senses. And I thought, well, that does seem like a deeply rooted assumption that maybe needs to be challenged a bit more. Along the way, in my graduate studies, my first time around, I ran into a guy called Fritz Ahlhoff, who was, he does weirdly, mostly like philosophy of technology, philosophy of biology, and so on, but he's also got a really refined palate and enjoys eating and drinking. And when I was studying in the program where he was a professor, he found out I was a chef and said, hey, I want to do this anthology called Food and Philosophy. Would you co-edit it with me? And so Fritz and I co-edited this anthology where we got to talk with and get papers from a bunch of neat chefs and professors from various disciplines who are interested in the philosophy of food. So that was the sort of major starting point for it all. And in that anthology, the thing I was most interested in is the question of art objects and what makes something an art object. And I was interested in that because food is usually basically ruled out, and generally so because of its impermanence. Right? There's nothing lasting about a risotto. It lasts only as long as you're eating it. And so in that paper, I was challenging how we conceive of art objects and argued basically that food should be thought of as a performance more than it should be thought of as something like a sculpture, right? They're different forms of artistic expression. Yeah. And so of late, after that, I was turned on to Michel Serre and the five senses, which sort of immediately reawoke that interest in the philosophy of culinary art and the senses, because he's interested in some of the very same things that I had been thinking about a decade before I ran into his work. That's a long answer to what might be a very simple question, but
we should definitely develop that. But you just mentioned philosopher Michel Serre, and who was dedicated to defending the prevalence of taste and bodily experience over that of language. And in his book, The Five Senses, he references the first tongue and the second tongue. Could you explain this concept and why it is central to your own work?
Yeah, I, in thinking about this, I think it's maybe more central than I initially realized. And I'll unpack that as I go. But the distinction to start out with between the first and second tongue is a kind of observation by Serre on the way that we've emphasized language over other forms of communication. So for Serre, he likes to think in informational terms, right? So as opposed to thinking about things in terms of concepts or thinking about terms of, like in Anglo-American philosophy, we talk about mental experiences we call qualia, right? These sort of qualitative things. Serre rethinks a lot of things in informational terms. So to think of language as being the paradigm of information exchange, he thinks is a mistake, right? Because information exchange happens at every level of scale throughout all of reality. And language is but one instance of that, right? So the first tongue refers to traditional philosophy's tendency to prioritize and emphasize language above all. And we run into questions about how word refers to object. We run into questions about how concepts relate to particular things and whether or not our languages get the world right, you know, those sorts of questions that are maybe secondary to understanding, right? And I think that's kind of what Serre is getting at. The first tongue then becomes a label for that way of doing philosophy and thinking about things conceptually and linguistically. The second tongue refers to the tongue of taste, right? So the tongue that we have, it's actually our primary way of engaging with the world, not our linguistic one, right? So you think about my favorite example of this, we've all seen a little toddler walking around sticking everything into their mouth, right? So he points out that our first interactions are not linguistic. We don't use our tongue for that. We use our tongue to taste our environment. And so we're gaining these sort of sensory experiences about the world well before they're conceptualized. And so that's really the meaning of the second tongue. Carrying on from that a little bit, I think maybe even you could go further than the second tongue. You could articulate a third, a fourth, a fifth, a sixth tongue. So you could think about the tongue as being the organ of kissing, as opposed to the organ of tasting, as opposed to the organ of speaking, right? You could think of it as the organ of stamp licking or envelope licking. So we can do a kind of de-differentiation with our organs, with things, with our understanding. And I think that's important for Sarah's philosophy more generally. There's this idea that things gain their functions in relation to networks that they're embedded in, right? And that's sort of a weird way of putting things, but my tongue is only used for speaking when I'm in a conversational setting. Outside of that, my tongue doesn't have that role at all. It may be the tongue of tasting, it may be the tongue of stamp licking or what have you. So this is a very anti-Aristotelian idea that things have a function that defines them. And for Sarah, it's the relationships that define things, right? It's when you put something in a context of relations or a network that things gain their value or take on a certain role. So yeah, that's the first tongue, tongue of language, second tongue, tongue of tasting. He's decoupling those and saying, look, the tongue has multiple roles that it can play. Philosophy's emphasized the speaking one, but let's now take a hard, let's grab a bite of the second tongue. I almost used a visual metaphor there. Just really hard to avoid.
So yes, as we're now speaking about relationships and correspondences, and on this podcast series, as you know, we're reflecting on the mingling of bodies, as Sarah's would put it. I'd like us to focus on the singularity of culinary experience, and more specifically, wine. We are often confronted with the anesthetization of the senses, not only through the standardization of our culinary experiences, but also in things like design through modular architecture, in language through corporate jargon, mm-hmm. and in social media through the standardization of beauty, if you like, which kind of eliminates the experience of singularity in favor of homogeneity. So a bottle of good wine, which expresses the terroir, the year, and conditions that are singular to that bottle, therefore the locality, you could say, and also manifests a sort of universality, which is independent of commercial imperatives or trends. So taking the example of a well-crafted wine as a reference, what would you say are the philosophical implications of consuming non-standardized experiences?
This is a really rich question. And so I think I'm going to divide it into a couple answers. So I think one point to make about the philosophical significance of tasting singularities as opposed to the sort of cheaply universalized taste experiences that we can have. I always think of Coca-Cola for some reason. Although weirdly, there are lots of varieties of Coca-Cola that are localized, but that's what I always come back to. But drinking a can of Coca-Cola from one year to the next, depending on what your country is not going to change, right? I mean, it's basically, there is no good year of Coca-Cola. It's just sort of standard. As you put very nicely, and I liked your example about social media and the way that it standardizes bodies. And yeah, great, exactly. So one of the things that's really important for Sarah, and I think ought to be important for all of us, is the idea that engagement with singularity enriches us as people in ways that engagement with sort of standardized, capitalized sorts of interactions can't. And they're just sort of incapable of doing it. And the reason that I say this is because having these sorts of rich experiences of singularity, whether it's an artistic performance, whether it's a really nice bottle of wine from a very good year, it awakens in you a capacity for artistic reflection that we otherwise don't develop, right? And some of this is born of Sarah, and some of this is sort of elaborating from my own reflections. We have this tendency of thinking, for example, of food, at least in America, it may be different in the UK, or I know it's different in other countries, but we tend to think of food as being this thing that we're supposed to eat on our way to doing something else, right? So we demean its importance. So hence we have the sort of fast food restaurants that you drive through and grab a Big Mac, right, on your way to whatever else. And we typically only think about food's relationship to a well-lived life in terms of health, right? Where we focus on being healthy, right? Eat the right things so you can be physically healthy and you can live longer, as if living longer by itself is the point, right? But it isn't the point. The point is we want a life that's well-lived. And so there's a sense in which, and I'll elaborate some of this a little bit more, having a capacity for reflective taste contributes, number one, to our ability to have wider artistic appreciation in general, right? So you develop a refined sense of taste by having good taste experiences. Number two, they enhance our possibility, our prospect of developing personal wisdom, and actually contribute to knowledge in really interesting and unique ways, ways that vision can't, or at least not as easily, I should say, not can't, but not as easily. So I think that there's a relationship between what we taste and these singularities and having a well-lived life, right? And not just the sort of standard, like stay healthy and exercise, whatever, have a good life that way, but to live one's best life requires developing a sense of aesthetic appreciation and a kind of wisdom that comes along with that. So that's part A of why these experiences of singularity are important. Connecting to that, part B, how exactly do taste experiences help us gain wisdom or, like, even deeper metaphysical knowledge about the nature of reality and really deep concepts like space and time? Right, which are the kinds of paradigmatic philosophical concepts about understanding reality. Like, what is space and what is time, right? This is what physicists are worried about. All the philosophers since Plato have been concerned with this concept. Like, what's going on? Or actually before that, Parmenides and Zeno. So what's going on with these ideas of space and time, and how is it that taste teaches us anything, right? I gather, is it Andrea or Andrea?
Both are valid. Oh. Depends on where you're from.
Well, I want to respect you and what you like to be called. What do you prefer?
Andrea's good.
Andrea. Are you from Italy by any chance?
No. I'm actually from Uruguay.
Oh, really?
Right, South America. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So I imagine that it's probably true that Uruguay has a very distinctive cuisine all of its own.
It has a distinctive cuisine of its own, but it's also very influenced by Italian cuisine and then some Spanish. And it's quite, in a way, standardized. You would be surprised compared to other Latin American countries. It's quite plain. It doesn't have that sort of, like, you know, spice. We use white pepper and salt. That's it.
Okay.
So if you give anyone anything too stimulating, they might react. And it's very hard. Yeah, loads of cheese and meat. As you know, that region is well known for its meat.
Yeah. Well, and you just hit the nail right on the head, that, to use a bad American expression, that region is known for its meat, right? So a lot of times, and this is where I think it gets interesting, tasting in a way builds bridges to other places, right? And if you want to know a culture, you start by eating it. Would you say that that's a fair sort of?
Fair, yes, I would say.
Yeah. So, and that's almost a cliche, because lots of people have made this point, right? So it isn't that by itself is new and interesting. But I think about this because I have a really bizarre hybrid family. I have an aunt and cousins who are from Vietnam. And I have my stepdad is from Lebanon and grew up in the Middle East. And so when I was younger, I was exposed to foods that people in my very meat and potatoes part of America weren't exposed to. And it wasn't that I fully appreciate what it is to be Vietnamese or that I fully appreciate what it is to be Lebanese, but I understand at least a little bit about what it is to be a Muslim in the Middle East through their food. And I understand a little bit of what it is to be East Asian through their food, because the food tells you something not just about the culture, it tells you something about the geography, right? So you eat the sorts of things that land will permit you to eat. So you don't have a lot of beef cattle in the Middle East for obvious reasons. And so you eat different things. And so you develop different tastes. And so tasting in a way becomes a way of building a bridge to another people and another place, right? Because you're experiencing something of that. So this isn't just limited to wine, right? The terroir concept extends further, and you can extend it to sort of culinary arts themselves. Now, what's interesting about that? Well, what that tells us in some sense is that space shouldn't be thought of in the way that we typically do, where we think of space as being like something you can plot on a map. You pull out the atlas, you put a pin down on it, and you say, well, here, this is where Uruguay is, right? And you can do that, but in some sense, you miss the point that Uruguay is a proximity relationally. Mm-hmm. Right? So Uruguay is always with you. Just as when I go to Germany for a conference, I always bring a little piece of the United States with me, right? Through a variety of different reasons. But thinking about this makes us maybe rethink space and time in terms of topology rather than maps, right? So space and time are foldable. And Michel Serres, the French philosopher we're talking about, makes a really big point of this. In fact, it's sort of central to his thought that proximity is always relational, and it's not a matter of sort of plotting, and it's not like dropping something in a container. That's not what space is. Space is a set of relations that are pliable and can be bent or twisted. So he uses the example of a handkerchief. So look, if you iron this thing out flat, what looks like it's geometrically far is really close when you crumple this thing up. And so because taste can show us the relationality of space, because it builds that bridge, that's one of the ways that we can understand topological space, right? Which it's harder to understand visually, because when you look visually, you see well-defined borders, you see the geometrical space, but it's more difficult to understand the folding. Does that make sense?
That makes sense to me.
Yeah. And so the same thing is true of time. And this is where wine, I think, becomes the much better example. Because when you, as you put it so nicely, you're tasting the terroir of a certain year. Mm-hmm. So right now I have, after reading The Five Senses, I laid down a bottle of Chateau d'Yquem, because that's a vineyard, a bottle that Serres talks about having really rich experiences with some friends over a bottle of Chateau d'Yquem. And I thought, well, I'm going to try this wine because it's supposed to be really good. So I've got one laid down for a certain occasion. And it's about, I don't know, it's a few years old. And it will be a few years older by the time I drink it. But when I do open that bottle with my friends on our occasion, we'll be commemorating something together. But at the same time, we're dragging that vintage year into the present with us. Because a bottle of wine is a sort of encapsulated or frozen set of temporal relations. And they persist through sort of the linear timeline that we tend to think about, right? We think about time as an arrow, but time is topological too. It bends, it folds, it twists. And sometimes the ancient past is really, really present. And sometimes it's very remote. Or sometimes the terroir of a given year, the climate conditions, the raininess, the workers on strike, anything that goes into affecting what's happening in that year at the vineyard, then becomes present to you, right? And so when we taste, we put ourselves in a sort of direct contact with the past. It's not a memory in the sort of mental sense of a memory. It's a living memory in the sense that it's still got a lifespan, this bottle of wine that you're drinking. So you literally are tasting the past as far as Serres is concerned. I find that idea fascinating. So this is how taste can tell us interesting things, and it contributes to our having a good life, not just by giving us a capacity for artistic reflection and our appreciation, but by giving us like genuine metaphysical knowledge. This is deep truths about the way that the world is that are revealed just by tasting. And they don't have to be conceptualized or visualized. Now, tying that into architecture and some of the other things that I think are really interesting, that I think you all have stuff going on about, isn't the same thing topologically true when you stand by the Elgin Marbles, or when you go to, you know, some other site in the ancient world, that some old theater where the Greeks used to do drama, or the Hippodrome in Rome? You're there in some sense. Right? You're with the past, and the past is with you. It's metaphorical at once, but also literal.
I think at the beginning of this conversation, you made a point about risotto and it being more akin to a performance than a sculpture or a building. So yeah, Teatro Mundi, we have thought about the idea of temporality and posed a question through our project, ongoing project, making cultural infrastructure to certain practitioners, such as architects and performers, on whether temporality can leave a trace. So yeah, our aesthetic experiences, such as eating a good meal or opening a unique bottle of wine, as we were saying, temporary experiences or rather permanent in developing our understanding of the world? What would you say?
At the risk of sounding evasive, I think both. I think they can just be sort of temporary moments that don't have really lasting significance. But I do think they do. I mean, they do have lasting impacts in terms of how they can influence your development as a person. I think in a way this ties back to the thing about quality of life and having a well-lived life, that if we're open to those experiences, that they have the possibility of leaving lasting traces, right? And they become moments of significance throughout the trajectory of our life. I mean, there's a trivial sense in which something is part of our temporality because we ingest it, right? So it's lasting in so long as it sustains us physically or biologically. But I think of an example of like taste experiences that really shape you as a person. And so for me, and maybe you've had, and I would bet, and this is not snobbish at all, right? This is not high gourmet. This is not, you know, when I was young, we had a row of raspberry bushes in my yard. And in the morning, I would go outside and I would pick the raspberries off the bush and I would eat twice as many as I actually brought into the house. And I would just sit there happy as could be eating raspberries. And so when I taste raspberries, I still taste all of the associations that go along with those experiences of sitting by my fence in my yard, or your garden, as you'd say in the UK, eating raspberries. And that was a formative experience for me. And I think most of us have a taste experience like that, where there's an awakening and it sort of stays with you, not just as a memory, but a deep part of yourself. Yeah. And I think that when we have those kinds of taste experiences, one of the reasons why they're particularly rich for helping inform our sense of self, and this is me speculating here, and I'm going to take another kind of Searsian idea and extrapolate it a little bit. He thinks of, again, times and spaces topologically, but also swirled. And so if you think about all of the sort of elemental temporalities that make up a human being, on the one hand, you're composed of matter that, according to sort of cosmology, goes back to the Big Bang. So in some sense, we're eternal, right? We're beings that participate in a kind of eternal scale of temporality. We also have an evolutionary history, right? We have DNA and genetics that shape the human being that we become. So we participate in a kind of evolutionary time. So we've got kind of a grand universal material time, a sort of biological time. There's also the sort of geological times that go along with the spaces that we're inhabiting, right? And then there's the family historical time of our cultural traditions and our society, down to the, you know, the individual sort of family relations that we've got. So we are all always this really bizarre hybrid of temporalities. And then we have our own lifetime, and we have the clock time of a work day, right? And then we have the sort of recreational time that we separate out from those. So anything that is any human being's life is a singularity of this really bizarre hybrid of temporalities. And why is it then that, like, the eating the strawberries as opposed to eating a big, or raspberries as opposed to eating a Big Mac, is one of those more significant experiences? Because in that moment, you're participating with more of those temporalities, where if you sort of go with the fast food or the Coca-Cola, the sense of that connectedness to other things is denuded. Right? It's stripped out. You just sort of like, it's a Coca-Cola, or yeah, it's a Big Mac. It's on the way to something else. And there's a set of immediate temporalities that seems to govern why you'd eat or drink those things, right? We call it fast food here in the States, as opposed to takeaway, which is you call it in the UK. And so the whole concept of fast food implies that it's the eating is something you do quickly as a necessity, and you don't want to think about all that other stuff, right? And so it doesn't really seem to have the power to leave those traces on you in quite the same way, right? Where that moment of eating something interesting, unique, connected to these other times, maybe to these other places, or at least to the places that help constitute you, those are the ones that you leave a rich, rich memory.
Now let us make a small leap, Dave. And okay. On this podcast series, we're focusing on the idea of hybridity, meshes, mixtures, and symbiosis. I'd like you to tell us about the figure of the parasite, which Michel Serres uses as a sort of fable or metaphor to describe the relationship between bodies, human and non-human.
In his book, The Parasite, Serres uses that. Chris Watkin, who's probably the foremost Serres scholar in the world, for my money, thinks of calling it sort of character concepts, right? So because Serres doesn't want to conceptualize things, he wants us to think them through figures of thought, which are sort of mythological or sort of metaphorical characters that illustrate something without trying to subsume them, reduce them down to a concept. And parasite is one of the most sort of central ones to his thought, along with the figure of the natural contract. I would say probably two of the most well-known. And those two ideas work together in a way that might be clear in just a second. But the parasite illustrates for Serres the basic form of relationality. So the basic form of relationality for him, and basic might not be the right word, it's sort of like the atom to physics, right? What's the smallest unit we can get to? And in physics, he says, we come to the theory of the atom. In relations, we come to the theory of the parasite. Parasitic relations for him are sort of one-directional interferences, right? So thinking about the world in terms of information exchange that I mentioned earlier, and this is sort of based on the work of Claude Shannon's theory of information, but a message or communication involves a sender and a receiver, and there's a channel between the sender and the receiver. And the parasite is a figure that sits sort of astride the channel of transfer of information and then siphons it off in a sort of one-directional way. So the parasite is a thief or a vampire that steals for its own benefit, right? And never to the benefit of the sender or the receiver. So it's interference in a message of a channel. It's a kind of abusive relationship where something that's intended from one sender to a receiver gets interrupted and siphoned off. So Serres thinks that all relations basically have these three parts, a sender, a receiver, and a parasite, right? There is no such thing as a perfectly clear channel of communication without interference. Without the parasite, there's no such thing as meaning. Otherwise, if there's no interference, he argues, you can't distinguish the sender or the receiver of a message. So parasitism, which is a form of abuse or misuse, becomes the condition of identity, right? So we can distinguish sender and receiver because there's a noise or an interference in the channel, right? Now, how does he get there? Well, Serres points out that the word parasite in French can mean three things. It means abusive guest, it means the sort of biological sense of parasite, and it means noise. So what he's arguing basically is that some kind of noise is necessary for there to be meaning. You can't have a perfectly clear channel. There's always a kind of noise working in the background that makes meaningfulness possible. So all relations start with sender, receiver, parasite, right? That's the basic model. So it's a three-part thing. He extrapolates this model to all kinds of different things, or maybe model's not the right word. He extrapolates the figure of the parasite to all sorts of different relations. And he points out that parasitism unchecked can be problematic, right? So if it is a kind of abuse, our first relation to things is taking advantage of them, right? So we're taking advantage of the sender and receiver. And he also argues that it's the tendency of parasites to proliferate themselves, right? Now, I say themselves as the parasite's a thing, but noise builds. I think it's another way of thinking about it. Noise swells and noise can overwhelm, right? And it's the tendency of noise to increase its volume. And he thinks it's the tendency of biological parasites to proliferate, mm-hmm. right? So you think about COVID-19, which who doesn't still think about COVID-19? Start small and boom, the next thing you know, we've got this pandemic that the noise of which, you think about, literally overwhelmed both physical and informational relations for the last 2 years, right? It stopped us from traveling. All you heard about on the news was COVID-19. Yeah. Right? So here you have a sort of literal biological sense parasite causing so much noise that it brings the world to a stop. So it sort of proliferates to the point where it overwhelms everything else. So when parasitism becomes like that, it can be problematic, right? As it scales up through different kinds of organization or when it drowns out the possibilities of communication, it can be a problem. It is unfortunately the basis of all relationships. So there's he also uses the figure of evil to describe it, right? And thinking about Leibniz and the best of all possible worlds, right? All systems require just a little bit of evil to work. You have to have some flaw in the system in order for a system to function. Nothing's ever perfect. But if the problem becomes systemic, well, then the system collapses back into disorder, right? So that leads us to the idea of symbiosis in parasitism, right? So if you think about, there are certain sort of guest host relationships between organisms that have a sort of different model. So I always think, because I live in Florida, I always think of the remora that go along with the sharks, right? And they clean their teeth.
Yeah.
So you've got these fish that swim along with sharks and pick out the dead debris. They're basically the shark's dentist, right? And they keep them from getting diseased. And the shark doesn't eat them because they realize they're benefiting from it. So you got these fish that hang out with the sharks, and the fish eat, the shark eats, and everyone works out. They're fine. They're partners, right? They form a kind of contract that they work together. That's evolved over lots of time and so on. But Sayre thinks that we need to manage our parasitism by turning it into symbiosis, right? And recognizing that other systems are things that we should partner with, and not things that we should just be exploiting or taking advantage of. Mm-hmm. And primarily, as he's most widely known, he's thinking about our relationships to the natural world. So if you think about our processes of capitalistic production, they're almost entirely exploitive and parasiting, right? So that we extract from the earth, we give nothing back, things that can't be recycled, they just go to waste, right? And we've completely covered certain countries with garbage, right? Just the way that a parasite does. It overwhelms the system with its noise. And we got to stop that, right? We need to start forming these partnership relationships with the earth, with other organisms, and so on. Now, how that works with the formation of collectives, I have a good time sort of thinking about this, or the building of relationships in the parasite, Sayre introduces the concept of what he calls the quasi-object, which is like a material thing that has to circulate between people in a collective in order to get them to come together, right? So he doesn't believe that the sort of standard political model that people are individuals first and come to join a collective by virtue of reason. Like I think his exact expression, I love this, is it's idiotic and sounds like a political speech to say those kinds of things. We're already always in a collective. We're always already in relationship to the natural world. And we find our subjectivity or our specification as opposed to our de-differentiation by virtue of our relationships within that collective and in possession of this thing called the quasi-object, right? So thinking about it in terms of the way a restaurant works, think about the different things that circulate through that environment that bind the relationships together. So you have the staff person who goes to a table and takes an order, right? They write down what someone wants to eat. And then that piece of paper goes back to the kitchen. The kitchen takes that piece of paper and all of their activity is organized around what's on that piece of paper. And then they are involved collectively in the creation of a new object, right? The dinner or the salad or whatever it is that then gets picked up by the server and circulates back out to the table. The whole thing is a series of communication exchanges, but it's all focused on specific objects.
Thank you so much for your enthusiasm, for bringing those amazing examples and making it enjoyable, really, the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad you found it to be that.